Well, it's, we say it's a 50% chance. The thing is, to us, common sense tells us that, yeah, the cat is either alive or dead. We just don't know because we haven't looked, but it has to be one of those things. It can't be both of those things. And the weird thing that quantum mechanics is telling us, and this is what led Niels Bohr, one of the founders of quantum physics, to say that if you are not shocked by the quantum theory, you have not understood it. And what it's saying is that the cat is both alive and dead. At the same time, until someone observes and then records that observation in some way, which means that both of those realities exist. And so that's called a superposition, meaning there's two possible positions, alive and dead. And the cat, which in this case is standing in for what I would consider a bit of information, is both of those until you look at it, and then you see one of those. So we refer to that as the collapse of the probability wave. There's actually an alternate theory called the multiverse theory, which we can talk about in a minute, which also ties to this. But nobody knows why this happens, right? We say, well, there's a probability, and one of those gets rendered. And so in video games, turns out we do this all the time. We have lots of probabilities of what might happen. And what we do is we optimize so that we don't have to render the entire world at once. So if my character is in a video game, like imagine that racing game I was telling you about, I only have to show what you can see around the car. I don't have to show what's on another planet. I don't have to show anything else until my character gets there, and then I can render just that part of the world. And so there's something we call optimization, conditional rendering, and it's an optimization technique. So most of computer science, and particularly if you have to implement something in computers, is actually about optimizing and reducing the amount of information. And this is why I like to say that computer science and information theory is eating the rest of the sciences, because many sciences which we thought were physical, like genetics. Well, genetics, the idea of the gene was actually proposed by a computer scientist named von Neumann well before they actually discovered the physical DNA, right? And so there's all these areas of molecular informatics, and all of this stuff is about information. And computer science is all about how do you reduce the information? How do you send it? How do you re-render it? That's why I can watch Game of Thrones, you know, on my phone, because it's going over the wire, but 30 years ago, you couldn't send that much information.
Exactly. All right. Let's say if I am in a simulation right now, and there are many probabilities available to me, but I'm picking out one probability. So my probability is to be having this conversation with you. So maybe nothing else is there except what I'm observing right now. And beyond that observation is what? I'm trying to hold this as, how is this possible? And how is it the observer takes the probability, the possibility into something more seemingly concrete?
Right. Well, this is where the video game metaphor actually helps to understand.
Oh,
right.
Good.
So this is what quantum mechanics is telling us, is that there are both of these possibilities, but then we see only one of them when there's an observer. Now, in a video game, suppose that there's like a dragon or an eagle that's going to show up, right? And the video game decides like what's going to happen. And my computer renders it based on, it decides based on the choices that I make. So if I turn left, I'm going to see the dragon. If I turn right, I'm going to see the eagle. But it's not until I make that choice and put my character there that it has to draw the dragon or the eagle. Like, it doesn't have to draw the eagle if I go in this direction.
It's kind of available, but it doesn't render itself until you make the choice.
That's exactly right. So we render only that which can be observed in video games. Pretty much what quantum mechanics is telling us.
Okay, so isn't this like one of the objections that people have to, oh, this can't work because if you're going to render the whole universe as a video game, then you'd have to have as many things as atoms in the universe or something like that. And they say, no, that's impossible. But so what you're talking about is the way video games work. They optimize what is being needed at the moment, and the rest is just sort of in the wings. Let's say if it's a theater piece, they're in the wings or whatever.
Yeah, that's exactly what video game developers do and computer scientists do, right? Physicists tend to use the brute force method sometimes, but computer scientists are all about optimization. So if I said to you, I'm going to have a fully 3D rendered world like Fortnite, which I don't know if any of your listeners play, but maybe their kids do, right?
Yeah, no, they might vary. That's pretty popular. Yeah.
Yeah. And in the 1980s on my Commodore 64, I'd say, okay, we're going to make Fortnite. And they'd say, you can't do it because we just can't keep track of all those, you know, pixels, and we can't render them. And therefore, it can't be done. Well, turns out it can be done. But the way that it can be done is, one, we have better hardware. But two, more important than the hardware is this idea of optimization in 3D models. And so 3D models render only that piece of the world that you need to see at any given time. And that's why I keep saying, you know, video games drive computation in many ways. And so that's one of the ways in which, you know, what we're really talking about is an information-based world that gets rendered.
Okay.
And then that rendering sits there.
Okay. If it's a rendered world or a simulated world, okay, then what is outside of it? What's running it? What is the base reality? Who is God? You know, or, you know, whatever it is, that belief system we might have or feel, but still, who's running the game?
Well, you know, that's the big question, isn't it? Right? And it depends on your point of view and where you're coming and whether you're looking at this from a religious perspective, or you're looking at it from a, you know, kind of computer science or other physical sciences perspective. And there's actually two slightly different versions of the simulation hypothesis. They're not actually different. They're more like a continuum. Okay. And these versions are the NPC version, which stands for non-player character. So an NPC is like an AI within the game. Like, if I'm battling an orc, or if I'm, or you're watching The Sims, right? The Sims, they are AIs controlled by code inside the computer. Or the RPG version, which stands for role-playing game version. And in a role-playing game, you are the player and you have a character that you are identifying with, right? So you exist outside of the game and you exist inside the game in a limited, smaller form that can't see or realize what's outside of the video game itself. And these are actually more of a continuum, because in something like World of Warcraft, you can have both. You can have player characters who are like the players, and then you can have the non-player characters. And so depending on where you're looking at that, you get slightly different answers. But I like to ask two questions. One is, why do we play video games in the first place? And then the second question is, why do we run simulations, right? So looking at the second question, we run simulations in order to figure out what might happen, right? Like the simulation of the weather or the simulation of a pandemic, right? But when you run a simulation, you don't run it just once. You run it multiple times. But the basic idea is that you are trying to figure out what is the most likely outcome or what is the most optimal outcome. Like, you would actually run it to figure that out. Now, there's a concept in computer science, which was introduced by a guy named Stephen Wolfram, who's a physicist who became a computer guy. And he calls it computational irreducibility. And what he says is that there are certain processes that are chaotic. So you may have heard of chaos theory or complexity theory, that you can't predict what's going to happen at step 1000. What you have to do is get to step 999 and see what's actually going to happen. And you can't see what's going to happen at 999 unless you get to step 998, which means you have to run the whole damn thing, right?
Oh, gosh. I love it. I love it. I'm going to have to interrupt you, but I am reminded when you just said that Something I learned recently with another guest about, it's called quenched disorder, is like if there's an ant colony and they all follow the same trail, and then there's one ant that starts to go a different direction, and that direction is what enlivens the whole ant colony, because it will find new sources of food once that is depleted. If they keep going the same place, they'll deplete that food source. So quench disorder is what it's called. And that's kind of, I think, what you were talking about possibilities, probabilities, and moving into other things. But I really want to talk about the intersection where you have brought computer science. We are not used to bringing science, is not used to bringing science and religion together, or science and spirituality or mysticism together. So help us to know how these two things are starting to blend.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I talked earlier about how religions will use metaphors of reality. And one of the most famous is that of a dream, and you wake up from the dream and you didn't realize it was a dream at the time. In fact, in Buddhism, you know, the word Buddha, the root is the Sanskrit word but, which means awake. And if he's awake, that means the rest of us must have been sleeping. And so, you know, this is where, when I looked at what Yogananda said in Autobiography of a Yogi, which some of your listeners may have read, it was one of the most popular spiritual books in the West in the 20th century. It was read by people like Steve Jobs, for whom it was the only book in his iPad when he passed away. George Harrison used to give away copies of it. Steve Jobs even gave away copies of it at his funeral. You know, Yogananda was a bit of a modernizer. He would take the old yogic stories and traditions, and he would use modern techniques, and he ruffled a lot of feathers in India from the traditionalists from the way he would teach, but he used an updated metaphor. And he was wondering about the suffering of the world, particularly in seeing World War I images, and he had a vision where he was actually there fighting, and he got killed as a soldier, and he was like, "Lord, why do you permit such suffering in the world?" And he got a very clear answer back, and he said, "Well, think of the world as a motion picture, right? And a motion picture was new. There was the new technology at the time. And you would project onto the screen, and light and shadow would create this scene, and it would seem real to you. And it would seem like the actors were suffering, but the actors were not actually suffering. It was a key part of the actual storyline." And so, you know, he got this message, you know, what are life and death within the cosmic dream, right? That these are just relativities within this cosmic dream. And so that was a metaphor he used when people were wondering about things that were happening in their lives. And so I believe if Yogananda were alive today, he would use an updated metaphor. He would use the latest technology, right? So he would say it's like a motion picture, except we all are kind of, you know, we have the ability to change the picture. So we have our own script, and we're all playing in the movie together, but we're also watching each other at the same time. Well, what does that sound like? Today, it sounds like a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, an MMORPG. So I believe if Yogananda were alive today, he would say we are in an interactive video game, and that there's a part of you that's outside of the video game, and there's a part of you that's inside the video game in the same way that there's one of us. And so, you know, when I began to explore different traditions, one of the things that came up was the life review and the near-death experience. So, right, people who've had near-death experiences report seeing their entire life, not just flash in front of them, but actually seeing a holographic 360-degree panoramic life review, meaning they're replaying everything as if it was recorded, and they're replaying it from the point of view of other people inside the game or inside the world. And so as an engineer and computer scientist, I think, well, how would that work? Well, we do it all the time with video games, right? We stream onto, you know, Twitch. One of my nephews, when he was 3 years old, used to tell my brother, "I want to watch that Star Wars game." And it would be a YouTube recording of people playing the Star Wars video game, for an example, right? And so that tends to tie, like in the Quran and in the Bible, they have recording angels who sit there and record everything that happens. Well, that's a metaphor. It doesn't mean there's like a physical book. And what are they going to write it in, Arabic, Chinese, English, right? What it means is that you somehow have to look at the things that you did in your life. And that is part of the reckoning. And in Islam, it's called the scroll of deeds. Again, that's a metaphor. A scroll is a metaphor because 2,000 years ago or 1,500 years ago, you couldn't tell them it's like a movie or it's like a video game. But today, it's very much like a video game in that you can replay an entire game from any point of view. And if you put on a VR headset, it'll seem like you're that other person. And so, you know, when HarperCollins India wanted to write something about the 75th anniversary of Autobiography of a Yogi, they turned to me and asked me to write a modern reinterpretation of many of the stories in Autobiography of a Yogi. That book has stories like levitating saints. You have people appear bilocating in different places. You have teleportation. You have psychic phenomenon. You have palaces being created out of thin air. You have genies that are being controlled. And you have all these stories, right? And what are we to think of these stories? And do these stories still apply today? I mean, Autobiography of a Yogi was quite popular with a certain generation, but a lot of kids today look at this 500-page book and, you know, that's not so well known. And so I wrote something that's more along the lines of bringing these ideas of simulation theory into the old yogic concepts. And so bringing them together to say, you know, that the world is like an interactive video game and some of the challenges that we face, they're more like quests and achievements. So if you play a video game today, you don't just play the game like going around the track all the time and that's all you do. There are these things called quests, and then there are certain achievements, and you accept those quests. And if you do, sometimes they're multiplayer quests. You end up doing, you know, goals that you achieve with other people, which is very much like karma.
So isn't in the video game world, there is a place, somehow they're keeping track of the quests that you've done. So there is kind of a marking, like an angel, you know, writing your deeds and quests. And so say something about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, that is information that appears not in the rendered world, like you don't see it, but it's there somewhere. And in Silicon Valley, we say it's in the cloud, which is an interesting metaphor. And turns out that cloud is where information is stored about what we did in the past and what we might do in the future. And we have what I call a database, right? It's a database of quests that you might want to participate in this life, and a database of everybody has a database. So everyone has their quest, and sometimes you have to do the quests together. And so that becomes a way to understand what is karma and how is karma used to pick and choose what types of experiences, you know, you might have in the next gameplay session, but also you might have a whole list of those, right? And, you know, there's some difference like in the Buddhist and Hindu traditions about what is the soul? Is there such a thing as a soul? Whereas in Hinduism, there is this soul, which is like a player and goes back in and takes on a different actor, different role, a different character or avatar.
So there, the soul is downloaded, and at birth, you know, there's a download, right?
Exactly. And it's a process referred to in certain religions as ensoulment, right? And I say, well, it's think of it like what I told you earlier about the ping pong game, right? It's the point at which you put on the virtual reality glasses and you forget what you were doing before. Right. And now you can only perceive what's inside there because it's so realistic that you forget about it. Now, the word Maya, the Sanskrit word Maya, usually gets translated as illusion. And it is. But there's some subtleties to it, which is it's like a carefully crafted illusion. Meaning, like if you go to watch a magic show, okay, you know the guy's doing illusions on the stage.
Right.
But you don't want to think about that all the time.
No,
you want to enjoy the show.
Yeah, exactly. I need to ask you, Riz, okay, how can we use all that you have said this entire time? How can we use it for the well-being for ourselves and for the planet? Is there a use for any of this? So what?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know, remember that everybody else is a player and a character as well, right? And what you do to them matters because it is part of their experience, and you are going to have to relive that experience, and it's going to be replayed back for you, just like it says in some scripture, but also like the near-death experiences are telling us. The other big takeaway for me personally is that sometimes, you know, things happen in our lives which aren't that great. Like we have bad financial issues. We have a lot of health issues, particularly relationship issues. Some people are born with, you know, defects. And you know, it's easy to get into the why me, why did this happen to me? But if you think of it in terms of a video game, and you think of it as a series of quests that possibly you chose to have an experience that is more difficult. You know, sometimes we look at other people and say, that guy has it so easy, you know, and sometimes people say this to me, oh, I know this isn't a simulation, because if it was, I would have made myself a billionaire. I would have given myself everything
right,
I wanted.
Right.
And well, it turns out there's, you know, in the Matrix, there was this kind of weird world. And they said in the first version of the Matrix, everything was blissful, but the human mind didn't accept it. Like, it was no fun. There's the guy who created Pong and Atari, Nolan Bushnell, used to say, you know, make the game easy to play, but difficult to master. And that is a great metaphor for life. Like, it's easy to play, you just have to be here, but it's difficult to master. And perhaps there's more difficulty levels, right? And so, you know, somebody who's born with a disability might have a higher difficulty level than someone who isn't. And they may have chosen to have that quest. That's a way to not let things bother you so much, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
perspective.
Yeah, to stay in the game. Yeah, Riz, we've covered just a brief little snippet of all that you have discovered, and people can pick up the book and really find so much more. Thank you so much for being with us. I just want to let our listeners know, I've been here with Rizwan Virk, and he spells his last name V as in Victor, I-R-K, Rizwan Virk, and he's the author of The Simulation Hypothesis and also Wisdom of a Yogi, Lessons for Modern Seekers from Autobiography of a Yogi. And to know more about him, go to his website, zenentrepreneur.com, or go to the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3793.
You've been listening to a New Dimensions archive edition, recorded in 2023. New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions.
Yo, it's Eboshi.
Hey, this is Eboshi from Cartel Madras, and you're listening to CJSF.
I was on the back of your mind. I was on the back of your lap. You were in the back of the car. You were in the back of my heart. I was in the back of the bar. You know what I do? Take things too far. Don't know where to start or begin. Don't know how it ends. Don't know how to say what I meant. Don't know how to say how I feel. Baby, is it real? I was like 34 double D's. You know what I like? Ice cold.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Bernie ABC.
Bird Note. It's Father's Day, so let's take a look at avian fatherhood. After his initial involvement, the male hummingbird has nothing more to do with the family. In fact, the female may move away from his territory because he can be so aggressive. Then there's the peregrine falcon father, which shares family duties almost equally with the mother. He helps incubate the eggs. And after the young hatch, he brings food for the entire family for 3 weeks. When the young peregrines fledge, Dad is right there with Mom, coaxing them to fly and teaching them to hunt on the wing. But the emu of Australia, that's the drum-like sound you're hearing. Now there's a father. The male emu makes the nest. The female lays her eggs, but then abandons the male to begin again elsewhere. The male remains on the eggs for nearly 2 months, eating and drinking almost nothing, never leaving the nest for any reason. And the father may stay with the young emus for up to 2 years. BirdNote wishes a happy day to all the fathers out there, feathered and otherwise. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein.
Masculine. are listening to